Hello, my name is Chris Durston, and this is another one of our developer chats from REST. In this one, I talked to Alexis Kennedy and Lottie Bevan from Weather Factory about Cultist Simulator and their history of Fail Better, which included Fallen London and Under Sea, writing for games, and so on. Enjoy.
So I'm here with Alexis and Lottie from Weather Factory at REST. Apologies for all of the noise in the background. Again, I can't stop apologizing for the world's loudest floor. Incidentally, no, it's okay. It's fine. And we are talking about... Well, we're going to talk about Cultist Simulator probably, but right now we're talking about if you were to be crushed to death and turned into a drink.
Yeah.
Not Ribena, is the
So line. I want to quote Quentin Crisp, who said that when you are revising for an exam, if you're doing a geography exam, what you need to do is you need to go to your encyclopedia and you need to read up. Encyclopedias are younger listeners, what we had before the internet.
Yeah, like Wikipedia, but slow.
That's exactly. It's like Wikipedia, but
made
for
tree. This is a podcast we've brought to you with a hefty dose of patronage.
In this podcast, or listening experience. Right, Quentin Crisp said, what you need to do is go to the encyclopedia, read everything about France, then you go to your exam the next day, and the exam paper says at the top, write everything you know about China. So the first sentence of your essay is, France is not like China. And what I want to say is that Cultist Simulator is not like Ribena, apart from a certain colour coordination, like branding colours.
Are you going to expand on that thought?
Yeah, Cultist Simulator is not like... right. Cultist Simulator is a game where you get to play basically the antagonist from basically Lovecraftian horror story, and you are summoning alien gods, and you are sending spirits off to murder detectives who are trying to track you down, and you're breaking into forbidden tombs, all this while often trying to keep your day job of forge a cure as a painter. And every time you die horribly... or go insane because the light of the world beyond is too beautiful, you can restart under different conditions. If you get imprisoned, you can start as a detective next time before you get tempted by powers. So that's Cultist Simulator. We're done, I think.
Yeah,
anything you want to say?
Excellent. Back to Ribena. No. So let's talk a little bit more about the how of this as opposed to the what.
Right.
So it is also a card game, to some extent, or a resource.
How we're pitching it is like, because we understand that...
How would you describe it? It's probably a better question than me trying to.
well, it's interesting. We understand that it's very important with your marketing to really clearly define your game. Mm. And really put it into something that people already know and are excited about. So we've ignored all of that, and we are describing it as a Lovecraftian horror card game,
yep.
Which is not a genre that we know, but we're just ignoring that. And it's also a text-based narrative game on top of that. So the interesting bit is that all of the mechanics and the narrative are wrapped up in this card interface.
Mm.
So when the main thrust of the game is you're uniting cards together, you're combining them to create new cards, new resources, and you're also unlocking snippets of the narrative as you do so. But the reason that you're combining them is not just because, ooh, pretty colours, let's see if that works, although you might find yourself in that situation sometimes, but you're doing it with a narrative intention, because every card comes with some sort of hint of what you should be doing, or tells you where it might fit into this larger story.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's what the cards come in.
So for an example, if you put your health card in the work slot and say go, it'll say, okay, you want to do manual labour. And if you put your passion card in the work slot and say go, it'll say you want to do painting, it'll open up another slot and say, what inspiration do you want to use in the painting? Ah, you want to use contentment. Well, that's quite a boring painting, but there you go. There's an option.
So judgmental.
And if you put a money card in the dream slot, it'll say, ah, you want to spend money on opium. Are you sure you want to do that? You can, and that will give you contentment, but that may open up an addiction timer later that causes you pain. And the contentment card, some of the cards in the game have countdowns on this. The contentment card only lasts for a minute and it burns to ash. So I don't like making games where people are happy. I don't approve of that.
So I'm interested in the, not attention necessarily, but the way you negotiate creating an atmosphere and telling a story and encouraging people to read and to take in the atmosphere of the game while also requiring them to make quite quick decisions about how they're going to use their resources. Contentment burns to ash, as you say. Was that a challenge to negotiate that from a design point of view?
Well, there is a really key part of the game, which is at the bottom of the screen, a big pause button.
Right.
So the idea is...
I didn't find that, and I starved to death.
And you are not the only person. And we've had people being like, I did enjoy it. Quite stressful as a game.
Yeah. Somebody played it on fast forward all the way through, just for fun.
Yeah, but they also squished Ribenas, so...
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, no, so the idea is that we wanted to give you time to read the text. Obviously, Alexis is a very accomplished writer, and it would be a real shame if he was writing and everyone was just going, click, 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 I'm not reading it. And because we do want you to make decisions based on the story and where you think the story could go, we don't want you just to blindly combine things and see what happens. So we thought that the best way to do that would be allow you to stop time at any point, which stops all the timers and there's no pressure at all, and allows you to strategize, allows you to have a think and read the text at your leisure, and then you can unpause the game and the timers will continue to run. So it's not, I don't know, it's not a subtle thing.
It's not, but it is.
I think it works.
So here's a kind of Jennifer Shirley game design is like a magic trick thing. It is not an accident that you overlooked, it was an accident that the pause time was something you could overlook. We've decided to keep it that way. Because I want people to feel unsettled while they're playing the game. I want them always to be aware that something's about to happen. We've done a lot of effort, with the art, with the mood, with the writing, obviously, with the music, which is Maribeth Solomon, the Sun and Sea composer.
The animations.
The animations, all to give the impression of things being sort of transient or menacing. And the timer constantly moving, so you know something's about to happen. Often something interesting, this is really the hook of the game, something interesting happens about every 10 seconds. I want to create that sense of unease. But very, very, very early on, I discussed the possibility of removing pause from the game altogether, unless you went back to the menu. And people said straight away, no, because, you know, some people need to answer the door, some people have kids, some people have accessibility requirements that make them a bit unfair. So I threw that idea out. But I like the idea that you can play through the game and initially get freaked out by everything being a bit menacing and then find that you can pause it. Because then you have that sense of menace from early on. But you can then start treating it more as your special. And the other thing, in terms of balancing it with the tech that we've got to read, is one of the design intentions, this sounds like a joke, it's really not, was for this game to contain about 25% of the amount of text that Sun and Sea did.
Right.
Two reasons for this. One, there's a really good discipline to writing small, and it means you have to be really picky and just kind of put the words just on the table in front of people, like jewels in a black cloth, and have them just recognise what it's for. And the other thing is that I wrote about three quarters of the text in fucking Sun and Sea, and by the end of it, my fingers were really tired. So I never want to write that many words in a game again.
It's hard. It's an often underestimated aspect of making a design decision.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, this is the whole point about Weather Factory was we wanted to make the kind of games we wanted to make in the kind of way we wanted to make them. And we wanted to be experimental and make games of small budgets so we could get away with having a relatively niche audience. And life's too fucking short to be doing things you don't want to do. You can avoid doing them. So we wanted to make this game in a way that we enjoyed.
Well, right. And it opens up doors as well. Like, two additional things of deliberately making a concise and compressed version of something like Sun and Sea.
Yes.
One is you can localise a lot easier.
Yep.
So we're hoping to reach some audiences that maybe wouldn't have read AK's Words before, which I really like. And two, I think it's a lot more inviting for people who maybe are put off when they first see a big wall of text. So, for example, my mum's an English teacher, and she loves the writing that she's read of Alexis, but she's never going to sit through Sun and Sea where she's got loads of menu to navigate and these big story lists open all the time.
Yeah.
With something like this, it's very, very bite-sized, so there's no kind of barrier to entry. And you might find it's not a game for you. Like, you know, you mentioned that we're not making games that will please everybody. It's very much a Marmite game. But if you do take one look at any screenshot, you know what you're getting. And as soon as you get into it, it's very, you know, it's kind of much.
I would like to say that Marmite is worse than Ribena.
This podcast is the end of Weather Factory. We're discovering so many things about ourselves.
Well,
that's what we're here for.
That's Rez.
Those little extra bits of content. So I'm interested in like, consumer is very much a kind of mind's eye experience in terms of mood, in terms of your sense of who you are, in terms of the kind of world and city you occupy. Like, it's much is left, as you say, writing in a very economical way in order to give you just enough to imagine the situation you're in, rather than spending a lot of money on art.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, I was just talking to the Disco Elysium guys, and that is 90% of where their budget's gone.
Really?
Despite the amount of writing in that game, it's actually enacting everything, right?
Yeah.
It is expensive, and both approaches are viable.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting is that, I guess, from Fallen London, Sun and Sea onwards, there's sort of a different, that ratio of sort of mind's eye through writing and implication to literally trying to show or enact seems to be a sort of bar that has swung one way and then back the other.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
That's alarmingly fucking insightful, Chris. Yes. So first of all, thank you for the phrase mind's eye experience, which I'm going to steal and may or may not attribute to you.
That's fine.
yes, you're right. So Forward in London, I wanted to make a game that was all about text. And the very first prototype I made of it was just sort of black text and white background with almost no R. And I brought Paul Aaron, who was later my co-founder at Failbetter, just initially to draw like 40 icons. I thought that's what we'd ever need. And eventually, you know, I realised that you need something to look at in between the words. But I always realised it rather grudgingly. When we made Sunless Sea, that's when I got my head out of my arse, I think. And I realised that if you are playing a video game, if you're making a video game, you have this full range of ways to make the player have an experience. You have the text, you have the moving images, you have the sound. And it was a really humbling and exciting experience working with Paul, Liam, and other folk on the project who could do things that I couldn't. So I could code and write them and be able to draw or music. And those things being as big a part of Sunless Sea's experience as the writing. And then going on to Cultist Simulator, as you say, the pendulum has swung a bit the other way because I wanted to make a deliberately small project. I mean, the budget of Cultist Simulator is less than half the budget of Sunless Sea. And that means there are formal constraints in the kind of thing you can do. And there's a really nice sweet spot between just doing tech stuff, just doing something that's more like interactive fiction. I don't really think what I do is interactive fiction anymore. And but still being able to add things to the game just with a bit of writing and a bit of art. So I think this is a pretty good balance, but it's by no means where we want to stick. I am very interested in doing a lot of different experimental projects with the manufacturing. You want to?
Well, I think I was going to say as well, I like the fact that this game has like concretized your fires in the desert idea.
Yes.
Because you mentioned that the player actually does quite a lot of work themselves to piece this together, which was always something that has been in Failbetter's work previously, but now I think more than ever. But visually now, you've got that image of a kind of deliberately dark, featureless tabletop with these bright moments of actual interaction with the game in between.
Yeah.
But we deliberately don't kind of try and jazz it up with the kind of Hearthstone thing of like really beautiful animations around the edges that you can interact with and kind of keep you going. But we specifically didn't want that. We wanted you to have this sense of the void that you exist in and these pinpricks of light in that.
It's really interesting from a pure design point of view that you don't fill the table. Sorry, I have an impression of the game board as a table or something like that.
No, it is, yeah.
Right. It is not, you know, there's so many different ways that could have gone. It's a blue expanse, which is kind of a calming colour. It's not a star field. It's not an abyss.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's interesting that it is almost kind of friendly or just sort of approachable or, you know, I don't know, arcane Windows desktop-ish. And then all of these kinds of other things come out of it purely through implication. It's an interesting kind of stylistic.
So this is exactly the intention. And the table specifically, Lottie mentioned fires in the desert a moment ago. If you haven't heard this thing, this is... it's a term I started using to express the kind of things I was trying to do back at Failbetter back when you first founded the company. If you imagine a desert scene from above at night, and you imagine there are campfires all across it, and you see a traveller at one fire, and then later at another, and then later at another, you don't know the paths they've taken between. And the fires themselves, the moments of experience you give the player, but the paths between, the ways they arrive there, belong to them. That's that them building their own story. So you want to provide these little bright moments. And the metaphor there works quite nicely with the bright cast and the tabletop. But specifically the tabletop, it is a tabletop. We want to provide the idea that you are an occultist in your study, doing planning things, without actually coming out and saying. Because if a detective is pursuing you, they don't usually obligingly arrange for a magical detective card to appear on the desktop in your study and have a timer appear around it, and then you're going to get a card pop up. That's obviously not what happens. But we imply that's happening. We imply the desktop. And in fact, this went as far as if you could pull back far enough, the desktop is just surrounded by a void because we didn't build like a chair and a person sitting in it. And when I was talking to my our UI guy, Martin Narakar, about making the Zoom work, I was very insistent we'd lock the Zoom to the edges of the table so that you don't see the void or what place where the chair would be and start thinking, well, actually, who's sitting here and what are you doing? And that gave us some problems. We've got a couple of people who play the game on sort of home entertainment sized big screens, and you can't zoom in because it's stuck to the edges, so you can't read the text. So yeah. You know, that's we don't support big home entertainment TVs. And there's a bit of fun metafiction that Lottie talks about.
Oh, what, with Iris?
Yeah.
Yeah, so have you seen our hero art of the lady pulling off her face? It's a very beautiful, striking image done by one of our freelancers. And our canon fiction is that she actually stands behind you while you're playing the game, and every time you look over your shoulder, she's just a bit closer. So yeah, you've got to concentrate, otherwise Iris is going to get you.
That's the kind of simulator VR experience, right?
Well, we have actually talked about it as an AR experience because people have said, like, is this a ball game in real life? Have you taken it for therapy? So there is potential there, but.
But Lottie,
from a production standpoint, it's nuts.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk
about
that later.
That's a silly thing to do, but exactly. A good idea. Yeah. I'm interested in, there's, I think, maybe to talk about maybe the sort of cosmic horror element. Like, I'm interested in the fact that, like, I don't like the vast majority of Lovecraft games because trying to enact things doesn't always work at all, basically. And the sort of mythos stuff. The vast majority of Lovecraft stories is someone rearranging papers on a desk and going, oh shit, Dagon, and then... basically, and that, you know, they're not just text, but kind of, discovering the relationships between texts and things seems like an underutilized aspect is actually central to so much of that fiction. Was that again a reason to tell that story?
It really was. So if you are playing traditional tabletop Call of Cthulhu, notoriously there is a skill called library use, and that whole section where somebody is going through the papers from the estate and suddenly he realises, my God, the family never left. They're still here beneath the floorboards.
My granddad.
The change.
Yeah.
So all that is subsumed in, okay, roll D100. Okay, yeah, you made your library skill. You discover that. And it always struck me back in my tabletop role-playing days that was a bit of a missed opportunity. So a lot of Cultist Simulator is really specifically about finding the old book in the bookshop, translating the old book in the bookshop, so that you can translate another old book that you've dug out of a tomb in Egypt with an even older language, so that you can learn two bits of lore, so you can combine those two bits of lore, so you can create a rite, so you can use the rite to use the cursed mirror that you dug out of the tomb in Egypt, so that you can summon a creature that's only visible in mirrors out of the corner of your eye, so that you can assassinate the prick boss at work who keeps making you do overtime.
It's 100% a narrative arc you can do in the game.
Right.
It's not a joke.
Yeah, I find that, but it's that, and that feels like, again, a kind of design journey, sorry for using that word, Jesus, from Fallen London to this point, right, where Fallen London, you are busier as a character in terms of where you personally are going and doing and kind of doing loops and things and then coming back and shuffling papers. Was there maybe this is not the question I was about to ask, but like was there a sense that you wanted to dig into the sort of single runs of experience that end, I guess, rather than the, this is a completely different question, I realise that I'm now asking, rather than the Fallen London Sun and the Sea thing of recurring loops of performing a, going through a loop again for resources, for example, or that aspect of those games?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Here's the thing about handcrafted chunks of text in a game. There's basically two things you could do with handcrafted chunks of text in a game. You could either see all of them only once, in which case that's very expensive in terms of content, or you can repeat them, in which case people will get bored of it. Repeating, so people tend to think, okay, well in that case, don't repeat the text, just write loads and loads and loads of text, which works up to a point, but doesn't scale. Or they think, procedurally generate text, which is another approach and which does certain kinds of thing, but you don't get the handcrafted feel. But the thing is, repeating text is not always bad in itself. If you think about a song or a line of poetry, often you'll use repetition to pause.
I think we're okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
If you...
It's quite directional, the mic.
Oh,
sorry, we're having some loud people issues. Continue, Alex.
Okay, right. So, repeating text is not in itself bad. If you think about poetry, you repeat text for a particular reason. If you think about chanting, you repeat text for a particular reason. If you think about
Watching a favourite TV show, the point at which text comes up in the credits, or spoken dialogue comes up in the credits, often that can be appropriate. And I think what you want to do is lead into repeating in the right way. So the wrong way is what I did at Fall London at the very beginning, which people are still dealing with now. Sorry about this. Where you click a button and it gives you a funny line of text, and you click a button and it gives you the same line of funny line of text. And the third time, it's no longer funny, if it ever was. Cultist Simulator, what I've gradually moved to is trying to find text that is supposed to be read multiple times or gets out of the way and just says, here's a thing, don't, you know, get on with the actual gameplay. Or give you enough variety of text that when you see a bit of text that looks familiar, it floats past like an old friend, rather than thinking, you know, I'm on the same bus journey to work every day and I'm passing the same bus stop.
And I do think that is the effect that you get, because one of the repeating tasks that you learn to do very early on is make sure that you're constantly working, so you get funds.
I forgot about that and died.
That's, you're not an only person to do that. And a lot of our feedback from very early playtesters have been, well, I find it a bit annoying that I have to keep doing that. I thought, once I kind of figured out the combination, and I could just leave it to do its own thing. And that is very specifically a design choice, because the game is meant to be about a tension between the mundanity of your everyday life, when you have this clerical job and it's a bit boring but it pays the bills, and the excitement and risk of the occult.
Yeah.
So we didn't want you to be able to figure out a recipe where you can just get a trickle of money and forget about it. Because
yeah,
that takes away totally from this tension, right?
But at the same time, this is a really good example of listening to your playtesters but not doing everything they say. Because we did want to make sure that working was a bit of a chore. We didn't want to make it a total fucking RSI chore.
Yeah.
So we have added a collect button when you finished a piece of work that dumps your funds directly somewhere you need them.
Well, and we, my point was the fact that once it's very, very early that you figure out how to make money.
Yeah.
There's a variety of different ways you can do it, and there's kind of more optimal way of doing it than others, but you figure out the leap pretty quickly. And it does feel really rewarding, even though you're repeating the same action, because the rest of the game is about figuring stuff out and making mistakes and not knowing what combinations work.
Yeah.
So when you consistently come back to this one combination, which gives you a resource that you really need, and there are, you know, random elements of variation that happen within it, so it's not like it's always the same thing, but you do know what you're doing at this point. It feels like the sort of very comfortable backbone of the game that you can then venture out from.
It's like
from.
A drumbeat.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's interesting, because I think I hadn't thought of it in that way, but now I kind of realise the role that plays, which is that, you know, obviously you don't want anyone to kind of ignore text or not kind of get the same thing out of text, but as you say, repetition is dangerous. By having that put to the side, as you know, I doubt people will fully absorb the work text every time they do it, right? It will become subconscious, but you are not almost like sacrificing the thematic meat of the game to that process now.
Yeah.
Is that a fair way?
It is, and I think the flip side of it's not always bad to repeat text is you get specific advantage from repeating text. So people do ignore text sometimes, even in a game that's supposed to be about the writing. Very early on in Forward London, we met with a kind of senior creative guy who said, with some embarrassment, I don't really read all the text in Fallen London, but I like that it's there, because it gives me a sort of, you know, it makes me feel it's a quality enterprise. And you know, we do get people who don't, and not everybody read all the text all the time. God knows I skim text. I also don't always listen to all the audio cues. I don't look at all the pictures. So if somebody's playing a game, they're going to divert different attention at different things at different times, and sometimes they're going to overlook the writing as well. So if you write something understated that's got sort of a joke or a reference or a parallel tucked away in the middle of it that people only notice on the sixth time through, because basically they're focusing on the rest of the game, that's also an effect you can use.
I think that's a talked about enough aspect of writing as game design. And it's just good writing, it's creating senses of inference and I guess is that one of the sort of things people should expect from Cultist Simulator, because I have done one run, right? So I didn't get the experience of like, oh, this has a different context now that this particular bit of flavor text has occurred in a different context. Was that a conscious part of the development of the writing of the game, given that you're working in a much more economical way, to kind of create different sort of inferential kind of links between things?
Yes, this is back to Fires in the Desert. They want things to start. Here's a really straightforward example. I did a thread on Twitter the other day about writing microtext and about some of the thought that goes into writing like 35 words of text. And it's a ridiculous long thread. It's on the blog now as well, about why I'd chosen particular words and rhythms for one particular sentence about standing stones in a field in Europe. And one of the things was just that I used the word remains in there, so that when you're reading that text over and over again, it does slightly imply that there's a corpse somewhere in the context without ever actually coming out and stating it. And a lot of it is like that. You use words that by themselves don't necessarily trigger a response from the reader, but when they see it in the context of other things. Or references, that's another thing. One of the fun things about building a mythos is that you start putting in things that have meaning on subsequent visits once people understand a bit more about the secret world. So certain things in Cult of Simulator have significance. Cutting hair, for example, or piercing the skin, or physical harm to eyes, or lanterns.
Buy this game.
Buy this game. Or ashes all have particular resonances. So when you play through a beginning and find references to those things again, it will mean a lot more than when you saw it the first time.
So you are almost done.
We are.
Yes.
How does that feel?
Good.
We're both ready for it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we're on target. It's been a really healthy development cycle. But also, you know, it's 45 and a half days till the game comes out. And I'll be ready to take a little bit of time off and then get back to making DLC afterwards.
Right, so that is the plan. So
oh, God, yes.
You mentioned the Weather Factory was sort of to allow you to do experimental games. Do you have a sense of, I don't know, not saying like frequency, it's not when's the next one. It's you know, how do you imagine that working?
I think a lot of it comes down to flexibility.
Right.
If we committed to a game that was large enough to take 5 years of development, that means that we can't do other things for 5 years.
Right.
So the idea is that we're going to have good ideas that we both were interested in that did new things that hadn't necessarily been done before, and we were going to get them to a good level of quality, and then we were going to get them out, and we were going to sit on them and make them become our darlings. Part of that is because I think there is a genuine problem in the industry of people kind of saying it's ready when it's done, and that being quite a toxic thing to let yourself fall into when you're working in a business context. Right. Another thing is just a boring fact that we're two people and one of them is a producer. So I was like, we're going to get a date, and we're going to get it printed, and we're going to get it out. But yeah, the game has been built with DLC in mind, right. And the card interface and design obviously fits very well with that. So the idea is that once we get it out and we get a better sense of actually how it resonates with the audience rather than just the Kickstarter community and, you know, Alexis's work, is we will put out some or a lot of DLC, depending on how well it does,
right.
And that will incorporate like new roles into the game, which will allow you to play with like different resources that are currently in there. So we have plans to include things like a family role, where you have to choose between looking after your totally boring, mundane kid, whom you love and everything, or, you know, chase after the occult, and that should tug at a few heartstrings of parents who are playing the game, for example.
Right. Yeah.
Or you might be able to come back and play as a ghoul, one of the summoned creatures that you can like currently only summon and then send out to do your bidding, which again is an interesting perspective on the game that's already there. So hopefully it should be relatively easy to add new content in should we choose to do that.
Is that something that you envisage sort of happening for a while and then naturally comes time for the
yes.
next thing?
Right. So,
I don't know how much we can say about your plans.
I'm not going to angle for it, but I'm just interested in how you imagine the company works.
I put together the setting for Cult of Simulator with the same sort of thoughts I put together the setting for Fallen London. The same ideas about how to expand and extend it. But I did it with 7 years of experience of doing the Fallen London setting. And Fallen London is still going strong over at Fail Better, 9 years on. So I would be surprised. I would like to see the Cult of Simulator franchise going 9 years on. I do like building, as I said before, things that last. How much of that will be me writing DLC personally for this game specifically, I'm not even remotely going to commit to. Kind of thinking half a dozen pieces of DLC, maybe more, especially because they need quite small packets of it. But we don't want to commit, and but I see us going back and doing more for years. You know, we built a game that can be bolted onto. We talked about using the same engine to do something noirish. I said I was never going to do any more freelance work.
That's what I was going to mention, yeah.
Yeah, so I can't mention specifics yet, but I've been approached by not one, not two, but three different organisations that I really, really respect the work of, that I would love to work with if they go out. So I've got to thread that round the Weather Factory stuff and go for it. Do you want to talk about your...
The nice thing about the flexibility of having these short projects is, you know, should AK decide that he wants to go off and do a freelancing project with someone he really admires, that leaves me with Weather Factory to kind of do something that has very low risk, because as long as I don't do something totally insane, like just gamble the company on a croupier night, I can...
If that happens,
I mean,
that's
that'd
a
be
good
story.
You know, a game studios fold for less exciting reasons.
But yeah, I mean, it will free me up to do things like investigate design plans that I have that don't fall under Alexis's terrifying aegis. Or, you know, to spend time skilling up on tech so I can be more paid next time around. But it's a really, it feels like a really unique opportunity as a company to enable our employees to do stuff like this. Because we don't have to look after 15 people and worry about salaries as much. So, yeah.
Which ultimately, as you people may know if they've followed my career at all, is why I left Failbetter, because I wanted to make some more deliberately experimental games. And at Failbetter, I built this machine that made a very particular kind of game. It's now making another very particular kind of that kind of game. And you know, I faced the choice between firing a bunch of people and running a small studio and going off in a lifeboat with a bunch of supplies. So I chose the latter. And I'm really glad I did, because I'm having a great fucking time.
Well, yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to leave and co-found a small studio is because it lets me do much more creative stuff and get more like hands-on with the game than I can when I'm producing a team of 18 people. Like, obviously I'm not the best choice to, like, let's just do some art. Shut up, artists. I want to do this now.
My turn.
Screw production. So, but with just us two, it's great.
So here's the thing about Lottie. Lottie really, really hates being bad at things. I've described this as
pathological?
Pathological. I think constructive irritation is probably the most kind of way of putting it. And what this means is that when Lottie did a couple of icons for the game, she wasn't satisfied with the standards, so she went away and suddenly got much, much better at art than I ever expected her to do. So she's gone from like an additional art credit to a full art credit.
Backhanded compliment.
Yeah, well,
you far exceeded my expectations of your ability.
No, but you know, there's no reason when I brought on a producer / biz person / marketing person that I actually thought that we would be able to share the production over the art as well. So I'm just going to, I think, I'll keep asking you to do more and more ridiculous things, like drug water buffalo, or attack ships, and just, you know, one day you'll come back with a battleship under your arm.
And a buffalo.
What project would that be for? A little teaser there at the future of Weather Factory. It's naval warfare,
dev simulator.
Buffalo poaching. Oh, yeah.
So it's going to be a massive IP.
There's already a couple of dev simulators out there, so I think we should do dev simulator.
Oof. Meta.
Dev simulator, dev simulator.
Yeah.
Simulator. And that's how the Ribena gets made.
Thanks very much for listening. As ever, everything that Creating Crowbar does is supported by our Patreon backers. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/Creating Crowbar. You can also find on our website at creatingcrowbar.com a link to our Discord, where there's loads of people discussing games and game design and tabletop and TV and so on. Join us tomorrow when I'll post the final episode in this series, a conversation with Hannah Flynn from Failbetter about Sunless Skies and loads more. See you then.